Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm Ray Boland, your host for this program, and with me today is Dr. Howard Glitzman, and we're continuing with a series he wrote on at Evolution News on the designed body, which was in 81 parts. And in this podcast, we're going to focus on glucose, but before we get there, I want to cover a few things. We all seem to have some good understanding that matter, the stuff that everything's made out of, is made up of individual atoms that are joined together by bonds of energy to form different kinds of molecules. And when it comes to life, some of the most important chemical elements in our body are hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, a few others there, but those are all joined together to make up molecules, some of them large, some of them small, like molecular oxygen, water, the big ones, protein, sugars, DNA, RNA. Today we're going to look at a particular sugar called glucose. So Dr. Glitzman, why does the body need sugars and particularly glucose?
Well, Ray, you know, we got to remember, like you just said, you know, the body is made up of matter. Okay, so, you know, it has to follow the laws of nature, you know, the laws of physics and chemistry. And one of the fundamental laws of nature is that you need to have energy to do work. All right, so, you know, your car uses energy that's stored in gasoline to move down the road. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way, you know, our cells use energy, the energy that's stored in particularly the glucose molecule to do work. Now, your car's engine, you know, it adds oxygen and a spark to the gasoline and it releases the energy like in a mini explosion. But the cell uses over 20 different proteins with oxygen to release the energy from the glucose molecule in a process called cellular respiration. So, you know, the short answer to that question is, you know, our body needs glucose for the energy needs of its cells.
Okay. Well, we know that our lungs bring in the oxygen that we need for our cells to have enough energy. Oxygen is needed for that process. But how does the body get its supply of glucose?
Well, experience tells us that our body brings glucose in through the gastrointestinal system. You know, we take in food, and it has various sugar molecules in what we, you know, eat and drink.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them are joined to others. So you could have two sugar molecules joined together. For example, you know, the common sugar called sucrose, that's actually a molecule of glucose tied to a molecule of fructose. And then the sugar that's in milk is lactose, and that's actually a molecule of glucose joined with a molecule of galactose. But probably the main sugar source we have in the body are these very large molecules called carbohydrates.
Hmm.
And they consist of hundreds to maybe hundreds of thousands of these, say, glucose molecules joined together. And the commonest one is called starch, and it's in foods like wheat and rice and corn. But when it comes to bringing in the glucose molecule, the GI system faces a dilemma because it can only bring in one molecule of glucose at a time. So it can't even bring in the ones that are joined together like sucrose or lactose, just even two together, never mind the hundreds of thousands joined together in these huge carbohydrate molecules. So the GI system solves this problem by sending out enzymes from your salivary glands and from the intestine and from the pancreas. These mix with your food, and they chemically break down these larger sugar molecules in a process called digestion. You end up with these individual sugar molecules like glucose, and the intestine then can bring them in and put them in the blood. So, you know, to recap, you know, you eat food and drink liquids that contain simple sugars and complex carbohydrates. The GI system, you know, the gastrointestinal system, digests these large molecules using enzymes and then absorbs the individual glucose molecules into the body and puts it into your blood.
Okay. Well, going back to the oxygen analogy, we know that oxygen is readily available in the air that surrounds us, and our brain tells us when we've got to breathe in, we don't even usually think about it, we just do. Likewise, our thirst center tells us when to drink, so we make sure our body has enough water. But how does our body know when to eat to bring in new supplies of glucose, apart from the fact that we all just plain old like to eat?
Yeah. Well, I think experience, everyone's ever been hungry. There's a reason why you're hungry, and that you have actually a hunger center in the brain that tells you when you need to bring in food, okay? And without it, or if it's not working properly, you know, you have no desire to eat. And we know this because it's a well-known symptom of many diseases. It's called anorexia. And clinical experience tells us that this can lead to severe malnutrition and even death. So there's still a lot to learn about what actually signals the hunger center. It's mainly different nerves and hormones. And the two probably the biggest, the two commonest ones that we know about are, first, you know, the sensors in your stomach, the stomach wall. So the wall of your stomach has these sensors that can detect distension of the stomach. And when your stomach is empty and there's no distension going on, these messages go to the hunger center. The hunger center sends you a message that says, eat food, you know. And there's also, what do we say? Why do we eat food? Well, we need to have glucose, right? So there's also sensors in the brain that are able to detect the level of sugar or glucose in the blood. And when they start going low, they also send a message to the hunger center, which tells you to eat food, right? Now, after you eat, okay, your stomach starts filling up with the food, and it starts putting out fluid and starts churning and starts digesting the food. And then the stomach starts to distend again, all right? So the message goes to the hunger center, and the hunger center turns off. And actually, there's actually something called a satiety center. It's a fancy word, but basically when you get, you're getting filled up, and that turns on, and it tells you to stop eating, okay? And when the blood glucose level starts rising back towards normal, the messages to the hunger center turns off, the satiety center turns on, and also tells you to stop eating. Of course, you know, we can ignore what our brain tells us to do, like everything else, like holding our breath or not drinking, you know, and we can either, you know, whether it's eating food or not eating food. But if we do either of them for too long, okay, you can have dire consequences, either severe malnutrition, what we just talked about, or morbid obesity, all right? Mm-hmm. Both can lead to premature death. So the answer is basically we have a hunger center that gets information from stomach distension and the blood glucose level, and it tells us when we should eat, and the satiety center tells us when we should stop eating. Whether we listen or not, it's another story.
So we do have at least some choice in the matter. But we know that our body's need for oxygen is so immediate or acute, you could say, and it can't store it, that we have to breathe in every few seconds or we die, one of those nasty consequences. We know that our body can move some of its water around from cells to the blood, so we can go many hours without drinking water, again, until we risk dying from dehydration. But experience tells us that we can live several days without eating. So what about the need for glucose? The body must have a way to store it, and it has to have some way to know how much to release later when we haven't eaten for a while. So how does that work?
Well, we just said, like you said, Ray, we know that the body needs sugar or glucose for its energy needs. And basically, and I'm going to just interchange the term here, you know, blood glucose. Basically, in clinical practice, we really – no one ever uses the word glucose. We just say sugar. So if the blood sugar level is above 60 units, it needs to be above 60 units for proper organ function, especially for the brain. The brain is totally dependent on the sugar in the bloodstream. Okay. And, you know, when you're fasting, when you get up in the morning, the blood sugar level is usually between about 70 to 100 units, okay? But then after a meal, as the GI system starts to digest and absorb the glucose, some of that is used by the body immediately, but there's usually more than enough, so the blood sugar level in your body starts to rise, okay? Now, you have what's called beta cells, right, like the Greek letter beta, in your pancreas, and they have a glucose sensor on the cell membrane, and they're monitoring that blood sugar. And as it starts to rise, this tells the beta cell to send out a hormone called insulin. All right.
Okay.
Insulin goes in the blood, and one of the main places it goes to is in the liver. And the liver cells have a specific insulin receptor on their cell membrane. So remember, you know, the insulin, it's a protein, it's got three-dimensional shape, and so does the receptor. And so there's certain amino acids on the insulin that attach with certain amino acids on the receptor, the insulin receptor in the cell membrane of the liver. And like a key in a lock that opens the door, when the insulin attaches to these receptors, it signals the liver cell to bring sugar in and to store it.
The
liver cells actually use a specific enzyme to chemically join glucose molecules together. And this forms a large molecule called glycogen. And it's sort of like the body's storage carbohydrate. You know, the glycogen in your liver is sort of like the starch that's in wheat, rice, and corn. So it takes time for the beta cells to react by sending out more insulin, and then for the insulin to go to the liver and the liver to react and start bringing in the sugar and to, you know, store it, okay? So over the next hour or two, the blood sugar level starts to rise. Now, we said, you know, prior to eating, you know, your sugar level may be 70 to 100. Usually with this effect, over the next hour or two, the sugar level rises to maybe 100, 120, maybe 140 in some people, okay? And then as the body starts to store the sugar in the liver, and the body continues to use the sugar, the level starts to drift back down, you know, 110, 190. And the beta cells detect this, okay, because they're always monitoring it with their cell membrane. You know, they got the glucose sensor there. And so they sort of turn off. As it starts coming down to 90, 80, they turn off producing any insulin, just a basal amount, okay?
Okay.
Now, Now we got the other side of the coin. What, you know, in between, of course, you're fasting overnight, so you're not bringing any new sugar. And also, even in between meals, you may be working and doing things, and the body's always using up sugar every second of the day, all right? And remember, if the sugar level drops below 60, we got problems, especially in the brain. So the body has to have a mechanism in place, like you said, to release this stored sugar. And if we didn't have one, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation because we'd be dead, all right? You know. So it happens that scientists back then, you know, they didn't have a big imagination. We've got the beta cells. Well, now you got it in there. You got alpha cells. Okay, alpha,
oh,
beta.
Okay.
I don't know why one's alpha, beta, but in the pancreas, you also have something called alpha cells. And they also have a glucose sensor, you know, sensor for the sugar level in the bloodstream on their cell membrane, and they monitor it, okay? And interesting enough, when the blood sugar level starts to drop just under 70, all right, that turns them on, and they send out a different hormone. They don't send out insulin. They send out a hormone called glucagon, all right? And the glucagon, just like insulin, it travels in the blood, it goes to the liver, and it goes to those same cells that the insulin just told those liver cells to, you know, store sugar, and it goes in there and attaches to the glucagon receptor, and it tells them to release the sugar from glycogen.
Okay.
And in order for the liver cell to do that, it has to bring in another enzyme, you know, to break up the glycogen, releases the sugar into the bloodstream, because, you know, sugar level dropping, 80, 70, and the body started getting a little nervous here, right? So the glucagon kicks in there, releases it, and, you know, all the organs in the body, especially the brain, breathe a sigh of relief, you know. And then as the sugar level starts to come back towards 70 because the liver is releasing it, the alpha cells detect this with their glucose sensor, and they turn off their production of glucagon and, you know, just at little rates.
Okay.
So the answer is how we control things to keep the sugar level above 60, which is what we need for organ function, especially brain function. You have beta cells in the pancreas that send out insulin. The blood sugar rises above 70 and to store it in the liver. And then you have alpha cells that send out glucagon to release it from the liver, you know, when it starts dropping below 70. So that's how the body maintains control of its sugar.
Again, a pretty complex feedback system that's going on all the time. I'm grateful I don't ever have to really think about that. But we're talking here so far about a fairly set range of sugar levels in our blood. I assume it's possible for the blood glucose level to get too low or even too high. Now, I'm assuming that's probably going to cause us some problems. And what happens when things get really low or really high?
Well, let's look at first if the blood sugar goes too high. Most people are familiar with a condition called diabetes mellitus, which is basically a disease of glucose metabolism. And there's two types. There's type 1, which is in a situation where the person really isn't making much or any insulin. So that's a problem with production. You don't have much insulin in the bloodstream. And then there's type 2, which is commoner, usually older people, overweight. And they may actually have more than the normal amount of insulin in the bloodstream, but the problem is that it's not working properly in the liver, so it's what's called insulin resistance. Sort of like, you know, think of it maybe some sort of short-circuiting. When the insulin goes out there and it attaches the receptor, it really either is not working properly, it's just not being effective, right?
Okay.
So what happens is in diabetics, after they eat this meal, we talked about the body breaks down the carbohydrates, starts bringing in the sugar level starts to rise in the bloodstream. However, if they're not making insulin or it's not working properly, then that level of sugar is going to rise higher, okay?
Okay.
And this can be pretty serious. I mean, I said the normal for us, you know, normal person that's not diabetic, the range, it may go up to 100 to 140.
Mm-hmm.
But for a diabetic, if they're really bad, it could go up to 500, 600, even over 1,000.
Ooh.
All right?
Wow.
That's almost, you know, 10 times the amount of sugar in their blood compared to a person that's not diabetic.
Hmm.
Well, what a lot of people don't understand or realize, okay, the average person, is that you have a certain amount of chemicals in your blood. You sort of referred to that before about the sugar, and there's other chemicals. There's sodium, there's potassium, there's protein, et cetera. And basically, the way the water is shifted in the body, it's basically related to the total amount of chemicals in your bloodstream is equivalent to the total amount of chemicals in your cells. Now, they're not the same chemicals, right? But it's the actual absolute amount that sort of keeps the water balanced, right? So when the sugar level becomes 10 times higher than usual, all right, this forces water by the law of nature. This is a normal force of nature called osmosis. Osmosis makes water move out of all the cells in the body into the bloodstream to try to reduce the concentration of that such a high chemical content there. So that you can just imagine all the water in your cells just flooding into the bloodstream. And then the second thing that happens is the kidneys are always filtering your blood and making urine. And because there's so much sugar in the urine, the kidneys can't concentrate the urine. So what they end up doing is the kidneys filter that that blood, and then they send out a whole bunch of the very, very dilute urine. So the combination of the fluid in all your cells flying into the bloodstream, and then on top of that, that fluid then coming out through your kidneys causes severe dehydration, low blood pressure. They go into a shock situation, and they die, okay? So in years gone by, before insulin was discovered by Banting and Best from University of Toronto, that's where I went to medical school, so I just had to throw it in 1921, up until that time, diabetics would only live maybe a few weeks because they could hang in there, but then eventually things like this would happen. Now, let's look at it from the other side, when the blood sugar goes too low, all right? And the best example is our experience with diabetics, okay, when they inadvertently take too much insulin. Now, too much insulin is going to signal those liver cells. Imagine the liver cells are, you know, they don't know what's going on in the body. They're just reacting to what insulin tells them to do, right?
Yeah.
Now, remember, this is an artificial amount of insulin that's being given. It's not the natural thing in the body. So if the person inadvertently takes too much insulin and doesn't eat well enough, et cetera, the liver just sees that all this insulin that's hitting its cells and it's telling to bring in more sugar. It doesn't matter what the sugar level is. It could be 50, 40, 30. It just gobbles it up and puts it, starts storing it in the liver. And the sugar starts to drop. And you could ask, well, hey, okay, what about glucagon? Doesn't glucagon kick in? Because the sugar goes low and the glucagon is supposed to kick in, right? Well, there's two problems there. Number one is a high level of insulin actually blocks the release of glucagon. And the second thing is, as we said, we're talking about an artificial amount of insulin that you're sticking in there. So it overwhelms the natural glucagon response, all right?
Okay.
So this makes the sugar drop low. What do we say? A blood sugar less than 60, we've got problems. Well, how do we know this, okay? How do we know it affects the brain? Well, clinical experience tells us when the blood sugar starts dropping, you know, into the 50 range, people start feeling weak and dizzy. They have problems concentrating. Let it drop from 50s down into the 40s, and they start having problems talking, increased confusion, maybe a little drowsy. Then it starts to drop into the 30s, and they may become somnolent, go into a coma, and even have seizures. And, of course, you know where I'm heading, right, Ray? It drops down. Basically, a blood sugar of 20 or less is certain death, okay?
Wow.
Brain death at 20. So if you think about it, though, think about this, okay? Having too much insulin shows us what it's like not to have any glucagon, okay?
Wow,
that
okay.
Basically wipes out glucagon's effect. So what I've said is the body can live a few weeks without insulin, but the absence of glucagon is incompatible with life. And so when the blood sugar goes too high or too low, you actually die because of the laws of nature. What do we say? This shows when the sugar's too high, you're dying because of osmosis, making water go out of all the cells, and you're dying of dehydration. And when your sugar goes too low, you're dying from a law of nature that says you need to have energy to do work. All right? So really, the laws of nature, unless they're combated by something that the body can figure out, you know, how to combat them, right, they cause death, not life.
Wow. It is amazing how so many things that we've talked about that you've written in the Design Body series just show an incredible array of feedback systems and monitoring systems. And with the glucose, the blood sugar thing here, I'm just curious now concerning this one particular molecule. Do you have any questions for Mr. Darwin about this?
Yeah, well, I think just to review, I mean, we remember that Darwin said that, you know, only natural selection acting on random variation was all that was needed. In other words, you know, chance and the laws of nature is all you need to bring about life, and that's what our modern Darwinists tell us, right? You know, you didn't need to have any intelligent input, no mind at work or anything to design it, you know. But I'll remind you that Darwin and his contemporaries only knew how life looks and not how it actually works. I mean, this whole discussion we've had, they don't know it. They didn't know anything about that. And in particular, what life must do to survive within the laws of nature. So like what we just talked about today, our cells use glucose for the energy they need to live and work properly. But they need the help of other cells in the body to get enough sugar in the first place, right? So here's some questions I'd ask Sir Charles and his modern-day supporters. You know, first, let's look at this at a macro perspective. You know, just to have enough sugar in your blood, you need a hunger center to tell you to take in food. You need a GI system to digest it and bring the glucose molecules into the blood. And you need the insulin-glucagon setup to store and release it when needed. Now, Dr. Behe would call that an irreducibly complex system, all three of these larger systems, because if any one part's missing, it doesn't work, right? So the question would be, you know, how did life anticipate the need for all these three things, and where did the information come from to make each of them? But then we can drill down further. Now let's look at the insulin-glucagon system from the micro perspective, all right?
Okay.
What I've already talked about, there's eight distinct parts needed for this to work. First, you have to have a glucose sensor on the cell membrane of the alpha and the beta cell. So that's two. The alpha cell has to be able to make glucagon. The beta cell has to be able to make insulin. That's four. the liver cell has to have an insulin receptor and a glucagon receptor.
Yeah.
Six. And the liver cell has to have an enzyme that allows it to bring in glucose and form glycogen, and another enzyme to break it down to release glucose into the bloodstream. So, you know, it's an irreducibly complex system, because without any one of the eight different parts, the system can't work and life is impossible. So, you know, once again, you have to ask, how could such a system develop over time while remaining functional each step along the way, okay?
Yeah.
But here's the critical thing that a lot of my articles are sort of pointing to, and this is probably the most important part I want to bring above and beyond what we talked about, okay? In real life, just having the parts in place isn't enough, okay? Not having enough sugar in the blood can be deadly. I mean, just ask any diabetic. These are real numbers with real consequences, deadly consequences. So let's look at this from the engineering perspective, okay? For the system to allow for life to survive, you need to have much more than just the information on how to make all the parts and put them together properly. To make sure it has enough sugar in the blood, the body first has to know how low it can go before it gets into trouble. And the insulin-glucagon system has to know how fast it can reverse a dropping blood level of sugar by turning off insulin and then putting out glucagon so the liver can convert enough glycogen into glucose fast enough to prevent death. You know, it's like knowing when you have to slam on the brakes to stop your car from smashing into something. It all comes down to timing, distance, and how well your brakes work. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, how does life anticipate its need to control sugar in this way? And where did the information come from for it to accomplish it? This is the Goldilocks principle. Everything has to be just right or else there's death. After all, of course, Ray, as we've spoken before, we're only talking about sugar here. You know, it's just one parameter, right? You know, there's things like oxygen and water and sodium, potassium, blood pressure, temperature, et cetera. So, you know, Ray, I think that if people, especially science students, you know, if they knew how life actually works, especially what it takes to survive within the laws of nature, they'd quickly come to realize that when it comes to figuring out where it all came from, common sense tells us that it was intelligently designed, and it's the Darwinists who are suffering from an illusion.
Yeah. Well, again, the amazing complexity of all these things.
Yes.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Glucksman. This has been ID the Future, and my guest has been Dr. Howard Glucksman, author of the Design Body series at Evolution News. And I'm Ray Boland, your host, and thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.